Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place in the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we're now in our Spring Pledge Drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. Please show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button, or texting kboo to 44321. Our goal for this pledge drive is $60,000, so help us get there by becoming a member today. For nearly 17 years, Oregonians have been fighting to stop the massive Jordan Cove LNG export terminal from being built on Coos Bay, as well as its companion 229-mile pipeline that would cross much of southern Oregon. In the past year, the struggle has begun to pay off. Today we talk with Ali Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director with Rogue Climate in Jackson County, about the latest developments that point to the imminent demise of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connector gas pipeline. Ali, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on today, Barbara. It's so nice to get to see you via Zoom again.
It really is. And some of these days soon, we'll actually see each other in person.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's happening in our near future.
Well, in the meantime, it seems like things are moving down your way regarding Jordan Cove. And so I wanted to start by just kind of doing a summary of what's happened in the last year, maybe last year and 3 months, in terms of permits being denied and things moving in directions that may be in line with your best hope scenarios, but really opposite of your worst case scenarios.
Yeah, we've had some really incredible wins on the front to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and frack gas pipeline down here in southern Oregon. And as you know, it's been a really long fight. But in the last few years, we have had some really incredible wins because our communities have come together to stand up against this project. I actually just saw today on my Facebook feed that this is the 2-year anniversary of the state of Oregon denying the Clean Water Act permit, which was a really huge turning point for our community and a really important validation that we're right. We do know that this project would do way too much harm to our waterways, to our climate, to our communities to be legal. And so that was like the first of many more wins that came after that, including the state really forcing Jordan Cove's hand to withdraw their removal fill application after, you know, over 3,000 people in Southern Oregon turned out to hearings opposing the project. And then the state of Oregon then denying the Coastal Zone Management Act permit for Jordan Cove LNG, which was another validation that this project wasn't right for our coast or our communities. And Pembina's strategy after those state permits happened was really tied in with the Trump administration and the federal government overriding the permits that the state of Oregon had denied. And this year and last year, we saw some really incredible moments where our state's powers to stop this project were upheld, which was really huge. And although in 2020 we did have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approve this project, this project can't go forward because it lacks its state permits, and now it lacks its local permits just recently as well.
I was posting a photograph today on the website for this show, and it's a picture of a huge group of people in front of the state capitol with a big banner that says, "Governor Brown, be a climate hero." And this was from 2018. And it seemed like between then and 2020, a lot happened, because I know I talked to you a bunch of times in 2019, early 2020, and you were calling on Governor Brown to be a climate hero. But it seemed that there was a certain amount of skepticism on the part of a lot of people that you work with that she wasn't going to pull through. What do you think changed so that the DEQ clean water permit was first denied and then everything else fell into place?
That's a great question, Barbara. And you know, what I think it was that our communities just made this issue so clear. It's so clear that this isn't a project that people were supporting, that the opposition to this project was diverse. Stakeholders, whether they were, you know, impacted tribes or impacted landowners, it brought people together, and when we come together, we are powerful, and we can win, and we can change the minds of our decision makers, and we can make sure that projects like this don't move forward.
So let's go back now to a year ago, when FERC made the decision to provisionally grant the permit for the gas pipeline and for Jordan Cove LNG. But it was contingent on Oregon permitting their side of the permits. So let's go back to that day. How do you think things have developed since that moment?
Yeah, so that was a really hard day for a lot of us. It was just after the lockdown started. We had, you know, just started working from home and figuring out what that was like. And early that morning, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved Jordan Cove LNG, which was really hard for a lot of folks, especially since FERC actually denied this project in 2016. So there was this, you know, feeling of doom related to the pandemic. And then, you know, even though we had these state permit denials, having the federal government come in and say, this company can take your land, landowners. We think this project is now in the public interest was pretty heartbreaking. And we think pretty wrong. And that's why Rogue Climate, represented by the Western Environmental Law Center and Sierra Club, and so many other organizations, tribes, and impacted landowners are suing the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for wrongly approving Jordan Cove LNG. One thing that is special about the approval that FERC gave to Jordan Cove LNG, which really does not happen on a lot of cases in pipelines across the country, is that FERC said that the project could only start construction, Pembina could only start construction if they received their state permits. And in a lot of cases, there are pipelines that construction begins on as soon as they get their federal permit, whether or not they have those state permits. So that piece, which is something that happened because hundreds of people intervened in the process to oppose Jordan Cove. They, you know, tens of thousands of people sent comments to FERC to oppose Jordan Cove. FERC knew that this was being watched, and they knew that there was a big question of state rights here. And so they made that really clear in their approval that Jordan Cove couldn't start construction until they had those permits from the state of Oregon, which we were going to make sure they were never going to get. Unfortunately, FERC's approval does give the company the ability to use eminent domain. And so that's something, even though the project isn't moving forward anytime soon, still hangs over the heads of impacted landowners and is a reason why we really have to fight this approval in court.
Well, let's start moving along this chronology of things starting to turn in a less favorable direction for Pembina and for Pembina's backers in the Trump administration. It seemed that after FERC gave a conditional approval to Jordan Cove, that since it was contingent on Jordan Cove getting the permits from Oregon, it seemed like they would need to go and reapply or whatever they had to do to get these permits, but they didn't take that direction. What direction do they take instead?
Yeah, you're totally right. They could have decided right then and there to reapply for state permits and prove to the state of Oregon that this project complied with our laws that keep our waters and our communities safe. But they didn't. They instead decided that their best bet was to ask for the federal government to override those state permit denials and really challenge state rights to make decisions about what happens on their lands and to their waters. So luckily for us, that didn't work out in the way that Pembina was expecting, and honestly in the way that we were expecting things to go too. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you know, upheld the denial that the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality did on the Clean Water Act permit, which was huge. That's a huge right that states have to protect their own waters, and it's super important law that we have. And then Pembina also asked the U.S. Secretary of Commerce actually to overturn the decision on the Coastal Zone Management Act, and that also didn't happen, which was really exciting, because all of that means that Oregon had the authority to make the decision on Jordan Cove LNG, and the state of Oregon, because we showed up again and again and again, listened, and thanks to that, Jordan Cove LNG is in the worst place it's ever been in the last almost two decades now.
Well, it seems to me that one of the deciding factors in things going the way they did against Pembina has to do with who got elected president last November. You think that's true?
Well, I don't have a like magic mystic ball that tells me if the Trump administration would have done differently. You know, I think we can assume a lot of things, but I'm still not totally sure. I think in the end, state law is pretty clear. Like, state rights are an important part of the way that our government works. And I think that in the end, I really think it was the law that prevailed, and that Oregon had clear statutory authority to deny this project. And even if the Trump administration had tried to overturn, we would still, you know, be arguing that in a court. So it's hard to know what would have happened with a different president, but it is nice to be in a more favorable situation with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission now, even though we're still fighting an approval. The commissioner who has consistently voted against Jordan Cove LNG is now actually the head of FERC, and that's exciting movement, and hopefully FERC will be approving less pipelines under a Biden administration, but that, again, I don't think will happen unless people come together and advocate for their communities.
Well, just a little glimmer of hope. I mean, I've been watching Biden, who seems to be sometimes a little slow on the uptake. I mean, he was really quick about denying Keystone XL, but Line 3 is still going through. And he seems to be selective in what parts of the fossil fuel industry he's going to take on. But it does seem that if enough pressure is put on him, that his administration seems to be going in the right direction. So I wonder if he can see the pressure that's been put on both the state government here in Oregon and now the federal government to stop Jordan Cove, if that pressure might start to be respected in the White House as well as in the state capitol here in Oregon.
I hope so. And I really hope that President Biden listens to the indigenous people who are calling for an end to Line 3, because I know that pipeline is in a situation that we have never had to face, where construction has actually started. And my heart just like really goes out to all of the amazing people who are protecting that land and those waters right now from construction. And I really hope that Biden listens. And if not, I really hope that that pipeline is stopped no matter what.
Well, I'm going to go back again to just a few months ago. It was the day before Biden was going to be inaugurated. It had been a rather couple tense weeks in Washington, D.C., starting on January 6th. And FERC was going to have a meeting the day after, or 2 days after the inauguration, but instead they pushed it up to the day before. I remember getting frantic emails from you and everybody else about we have to put pressure on FERC to put their meeting when it's supposed to happen, because there was a lot of fear that the last act that Trump would do would be to have FERC uphold their permit and to deny Oregon our state's rights. So let's talk about what happened that day.
Yeah, you're totally right. So we saw that the FERC meeting had been shifted from after Biden's inauguration to before Biden's inauguration, and that just smelled really fishy to us. And it wasn't just Jordan Cove that was on the list. There were, like, I think about a dozen pipelines all across the country that were on this list for their agenda, and it was very concerning. And so we were really worried that that was going to be the moment where they told us that the state of Oregon's denial of the Clean Water Act wasn't valid. And so, you know, we do what we do best here in Oregon. We organized, right? We sent out an action alert, and all of our partners and friends all across the state in Northern California shared it out, and we told people to call FERC and tell them to not move up their meeting and to not support Jordan Cove LNG. And so we filled the mailbox. The voicemail was full very quickly, but people kept calling. And unfortunately, FERC didn't change the date of their meeting, but our prediction about what was going to happen on Jordan Cove was wrong. And that was the day that they actually upheld the state's Clean Water Act denial, which was a really shocking and exciting day for us, because again, that is just such an important state right to be able to protect state waterways.
Well, I was wondering if they upheld Oregon's right to deny the permits, If that was in fact a result of all those phone calls and their overflowing voicemail box and the emails that everybody sent.
I'd like to think that it's a cumulative effort of the last over 15 years of, you know, showing up every single time we could in that FERC process, including those calls. I think that there was a really clear legal reason that they couldn't do it, and there was a really, like, well-prepared legal brief on why Oregon's authority upheld. So it's hard for me to imagine that one day made that happen. But I know that over 15 years of organizing definitely did. And I also know that the commissioners were totally aware of the amount of emails and phone calls that they got that day from Oregon and then from across the rest of the country once they realized what was happening. So I think they knew they were being watched. And I think it's always important that our decision makers know that communities are watching them and are going to hold them accountable.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Ali Rosenbluth, who's a campaigns director with Rogue Climate in Jackson County. And we're talking about the imminent demise of Jordan Cove LNG. So after FERC made that surprising decision back in, I think it was January 19th, let's talk about what's happened since then, which is beginning to point more and more to life after Jordan Cove LNG.
Yeah, so since FERC approved Jordan Cove LNG, you know, we talked about all of the state permits that have been upheld. Our coalition has challenged the approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you know, saying that it was unlawful and that this project is not in the public's interest. It's really exciting the people who have come together to challenge the FERC lawsuit. So impacted landowners who are being represented by the Niskanen Center, multiple tribes, the state of Oregon, and then environmental organizations and community organizations like Rogue Climate who work on stopping Jordan Cove and protecting our climate and our communities. So it's a wide range of interests who are pushing back on FERC's approval, which is really exciting. And this, you know, the state of Oregon is challenging this lawsuit again because of the thousands and thousands of people who have expressed concerns about Jordan Cove LNG, you know, who showed up in Salem every chance they could, who talked to their legislators about it, who showed up at Governor Kate Brown's every single thing that she did for the last 4 years, you know, attending those state land board meetings, all of the incredible work at the city council meetings in Coos Bay, all of that paid off. And, you know, the state didn't just deny the permits for Jordan Cove LNG, but they're actually with us on challenging the permit that was approved. So that's really exciting, too.
I understand that Jordan Cove was trying to do a little bit of funny business around this lawsuit. What was going on there?
Yeah, so just a few weeks ago, Pembina, the Canadian Fossil Fuel Corporation that owns Jordan Cove LNG, requested a pause on the federal lawsuit challenging their approval. And when you just hear this, it sounds like a good thing, right? It sounds like Jordan Cove really doesn't have their stuff together, and they're even having to pause this federal litigation because, you know, this project isn't going to happen. While I think that is true, on the other side, they are putting a pause on a permit that they have approved, which helps them keep that permit. And it takes our community's rights away to be able to challenge this project in federal court. And that's so critical because we've seen this project come back from the dead multiple times. We want it totally canceled, totally dead. We want every single permit reversed or denied. And if this lawsuit is paused, we won't be able to challenge it, and we won't be able to win and reverse this permit as well. And that's so critical, not just because we want this project as dead as it can get, but also because the FERC permit gives this company the right to use eminent domain. And even though it really doesn't seem like the company is planning on doing that anytime soon, the impact that has on people's lives to know at any time that could change is really intense. And nobody deserves to live with that weight on their shoulders. And I think it's really, really critical that as people who don't have properties impacted by this project, that we stand with our neighbors and we fight back this project in every form so that they don't have to lose another night of sleep thinking about a pipeline going through their homes.
So what is the state of this request for a pause? Has it been granted, or are you still fighting it, or is it up in the air?
We don't have a decision yet. It's up in the air, but the tribes and the landowners and the environmental organizations have all sent their opposition to DC Circuit Court to say that a pause is not fair. So we really hope that a pause does not happen and we can continue with this lawsuit, and we will make sure that this project is canceled for good, no matter what. But we want to really make sure that this permit doesn't hold.
Well, there seems to be a couple more pieces of interesting news about Jordan Cove. One is, I understand that they've taken down their website. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so that was a fun surprise. I think Francis Etherington went to go to jordancovelng.com and it said, no start. This is a no start page, which someone on Twitter made a really great joke about, that Jordan Cove was always a no start project. Actually, I think that was Pam Ordway Brown who made that joke, if I'm remembering correctly. So they took down their main Jordan Cove LNG website. They really, you know, they've closed their offices, all of their offices in Oregon. They don't really have like a press team anymore. They don't have staff here in Oregon. They're really, really void in Southern Oregon and across the state. So that's really exciting. You know, while the Jordan Cove LNG like project section on the Pembina website still remains, I don't think it's going to be there for much longer. And, you know, we all are going to have to join together to make sure this project is canceled for good. And that's going to be, I think, some more exciting work to do in the next couple of months to get that final nail in this coffin and really see the end of Jordan Cove LNG.
Well, it does seem if a company takes down their website that they're not planning on doing business too much into the future.
Yeah, one would think so, but you never know with these fossil fuel corporations what they're up to, and you never know with Jordan Cove LNG when it's going to rise from the dead again. So while that permit remains, we will continue to fight and call for a cancellation. And I think Pembina sees the writing on the wall, and they just need to give in at this point and cancel Jordan Cove LNG for good, so we don't have to think about it. And we can move on to building the communities that we want to see.
Well, it seems like there was like some major more spray painting on the wall just recently with some decisions at the state level with LUBA. So let's talk a bit about what that was about.
Yeah, so we got two really exciting permit reversals this week, which is so exciting. First of all, I want to give a major shout out to the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, who was represented by Craig Lawson, Citizens for Renewables, who was represented by Tanya Morrow, and the Confederated Tribes of Kuslo, Umpqua, and Siusla, who took these land use permits to the Land Use Board of Appeal, along with Rogue Climate, who was also represented by Tanya Morrow.
Now, what were the permits that had been granted locally?
The City of Coos Bay and Coos County both approved permits that would have allowed Jordan Cove LNG to dredge in protected parts of the Coos Bay estuary. So their argument was that this project did enough public good that the laws that protect Coos Bay and protect those protected aquatic zones didn't matter. And unfortunately, but not surprisingly, Coos County voted to approve that permit. And the City of Coos Bay, although it was a tie that the mayor broke, also voted to approve that permit. And so those were challenged. The lead plaintiffs were Oregon Shores and the tribes on those respective cases. And just a few days ago, we heard from the Land Use Board of Appeals that both of those permit decisions were reversed, which doesn't mean that they have to change their arguments or just like tweak their application. It means the activity that Jordan Cove was trying to do to dredge in the bay and these protected zones is just unlawful, which is great. And it means that the Coos Bay Estuary Management Plan really is holding up to do its job to protect the bay, although it really does need an update because it hasn't been updated in the last 40 years. So this is huge because Pembina can't get these ships to the export terminal without significantly changing the channel in Coos Bay. And if they can't dredge in these protected zones, they can't really change the channel for these boats to enter the North Spit.
Well, I found it very twisted and interesting how Pembina was claiming that they were not the ones who were making this request to dredge the bay, that it was actually coming from, I guess, the city and the county. And I went to a city council meeting where the lawyer for Pembina is making that case. But all the slides about why they should be doing the dredging had the imprint of Pembina on them in the corner. And it was the Pembina lawyer who was speaking. And it seemed to me that it was a very strange attempt at a subterfuge, which perhaps worked at the county level, but obviously didn't work at the state level.
Yeah, so that's a really confusing piece. This is different than the other dredging project that's proposed, supposedly by the Port of Coos Bay, but Pembina has been paying for it for years. And so this is dredging that Jordan Cove LNG is applying for. There is other dredging that hasn't even started its NEPA process, so it's like environmental review process, that has been paid for by Jordan Cove LNG for the benefit of Jordan Cove LNG to dredge even more, and that the Port of Coos Bay is kind of shepherding as their own. And so it's a very confusing situation, but that project isn't moving forward either right now, especially with Jordan Cove on the line like this. There isn't a clear need for doing this dredging that would change the shape of the bay forever for a project that's not going to happen.
Well, it also seems like there's a precedent that it shows that, as you were saying, that the Coastal Management Act really means something, and that the plans, the protection that Coos Bay has right now as an estuary also means something.
Yeah, so the Coos Bay Estuary Management Plan, which is like a group of policies and goals that kind of like talk about how the Coos Bay can be managed, it has these protected zones in it, right? And what is so great about this ruling is that it shows that this law does matter, and that a private corporation can't just come in and pay a bunch of money to get what they want and have it happen. So that's really exciting. And you're right, too. This actually really does impact the Coastal Zone Management Act, too, because these land use decisions matter so much because they're in the coastal zone in Oregon, which has its own coastal zone management plan. And if the company can't get their land use permits in the coastal zone, then they can't get their coastal zone management permit from the state of Oregon, which again, they can't build without. So it's like this cascading impact of all of these failures of Jordan Cove LNG that we're still watching. And it's really fun because it, I know, means so much to so many people. And I know the reason why all of this is happening, because all of those people spoke out and showed up and were a part of this movement and continue to be a part of this movement for the rest of their lives.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Ali Rosenbluth, who's a campaigns director with Rogue Climate in Jackson County. We've been talking about the near demise of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal down in Coos Bay. And we're going to shift now to talking about, rather than trying to stop fossil fuel projects, we're talking about the next phase of life here in Oregon, which is to try to promote a green future. So let's talk about what's happening in the state legislature during this session, which seems to be not going as smoothly as I understand the Washington state legislature has been going. But what's on the table and what do you have hopes for?
Yeah, so Rogue Climate is part of the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, which is a coalition of environmental and climate justice organizations across the state and their close allies working to ensure that we have a transition to clean energy that doesn't results in higher energy bills for those already struggling to pay their bills. And that really does create good jobs and economic development in clean energy projects that are good for communities and that communities are excited about. So we have three different bills that are in the Salem process. So the first one that I'd like to talk about is the Energy Affordability Act. And this bill actually will be voted on in the Senate probably in the next week or two. And then it'll go to the governor's office for her to sign off on. And we will have passed a bill, which is really exciting.
So it's already passed the House, I take it.
It already did that, yeah.
And the Republicans haven't left town?
Well, this is a bill that, you know, rural Oregonians really do need. So the Energy Affordability Bill actually lets the PUC create a low-income rate class for energy bills. So if you're a person who's already struggling paying your energy bills, this could lead to you paying lower rates for your electricity. So that you don't have to choose between putting food on your table and keeping your power on. So we think that this is really critical in the transition to clean energy. And it's just really critical even today when we're using fossil fuels. Rural Oregon is the most energy burdened in the state, you know, Coos County and some counties in Eastern Oregon. It's a very high rate of energy burden and a very high rate of people who can't regularly afford their energy bills. And that's something that we should move past in Oregon.
Now, I'm curious, so that has gotten bipartisan support and Republicans are not balking at it?
Yeah, it has bipartisan support. Mm-hmm.
Does this at all address the Republicans' concerns why they left the state last year when the cap and trade bill was being debated?
This isn't really related to the cap and trade bill. So, you know, unfortunately, this bill actually was being run last year. And when the walkout did happen, this was one of the bills that was impacted. But it wasn't a bill that Republicans were upset about. It was actually bipartisan support. And I think it's really important that we focus on what brings us together rather than on like what party someone is. And, you know, the Oregon legislature has a long history of not being able to work together, and our communities deserve better than that. We deserve a functioning legislature that makes laws that are good for people and help improve their lives.
So what are the other two bills?
The next bill that I want to talk about is the Healthy Homes Bill. The Healthy Homes Bill creates a program in the Oregon Housing Authority for low-income households to get energy upgrades, other home upgrades that help people be healthy, right? You know, I think one of the leading causes of missed school and work days is asthma, right? And a lot of that is because of indoor air quality, because, you know, there's mold in people's houses, or you know, it's not, your house isn't airtight, right? And that's really important. In addition to, we need to be saving energy in this transition to clean energy. We need to be more efficient, and we need to reduce the amount of energy that we're consuming, and we can do that through really simple measures like insulating our houses and, you know, getting double pane windows. And the reality is a lot of Oregonians can't afford to do that on their own. And so this bill allows for the state of Oregon to put funding towards low-income households to do that kind of work. And in addition to these kind of like home upgrades that I talked about that like help improve health, one of the things that, you know, Rogue Climate really fought for in this bill was also for that to include home hardening against future wildfires, because obviously with the Alameda fire being something that we're still responding to this day, it's really important for our communities, and we've seen firsthand that low-income communities and communities of color are the first and worst hit by climate crises like the Alameda fire.
So are there any bills that are going before the legislature that actually deal directly with climate change issues?
Yeah, I think all of these bills deal directly with climate change issues, and we have to not think so narrowly when we think about climate as just greenhouse gases, right? We know that the climate impacts nearly everything that we do in our lives. And we know that our energy system is such a huge contributor to climate change, that we have to look in a holistic way, right? How are we reducing energy? How are we making sure that people who are already struggling to pay their bills aren't struggling even more? And then, of course, our third bill, which is the 100% clean energy bill, is that mandate for our utilities to shift from fossil fuels to 100% clean energy by 2040. So we see these as bills that really come together as a package and address things in a more holistically way, so that we can really make sure that our transition to clean energy is not doing further harm to communities, and that actually it's leading to economic development in communities in Oregon that truly need it. And so some of the things that I'm excited about in the 100% clean energy bill are a little bit nerdy, but I want to talk about it because I think it's so important. And so the first is the community-based energy projects. So these are projects that are either owned by a tribe, owned by a municipality, owned by a community-based organization or a cooperative. So they're clean energy projects that have people owning it instead of corporations. Or they are clean energy projects that have started with a community benefits agreement. So it's the developer and the communities getting together and saying, actually, you know, what we need in this project is for it to not do harm to X, Y, and Z, you know, and actually like saying up front what we need and having a legal agreement that ensures that our communities don't have clean energy projects that are harmful in some of the ways that fossil fuel projects can be, right? If they disturb cultural resources, if they, impact our water, so on and so forth. And so this bill actually creates a pot of money for those types of projects to exist, right? And so right now there's a lot of interest and a lot of places where these projects could go, these community-based clean energy projects that like really center what a community wants. And this gives the funding that's needed to do it, which is really exciting. And hopefully it's just the beginning for the like community-owned clean energy future that we really wanna see. And then the next thing that I'm really excited about in this bill is the labor standards. So as we transition to clean energy, we need to make sure that we're taking care of our workers and that workers who hold jobs in the clean energy industry can actually put food on the table for their families, can actually afford their rent, can actually have health care, have benefits that people need to thrive and should be a given, but unfortunately they're not. And so this bill also includes labor standards that help ensure that this transition to clean energy is good for workers. And so, you know, it's a really exciting bill, and it's really exciting to think about Oregon, you know, switching from fossil fuels to clean energy. And I think it's really important that we think about clean energy with nuance too, right? Like I want to hold that some clean energy projects do harm, right? And I think that I'm really excited for future sessions and future policies to ensure that our energy siting actually does put communities and put sovereign nations, sovereign tribes first before the interests of the developers the money that they intend to make. So that's kind of the spread in Salem right now in the legislature. And it really does feel like all of these bills have a path forward because they're bills that are good for our communities and they will result in real changes for people, for their lives, for the better.
How would you compare that with the bills from the last two sessions that were stymied by the Republicans? In fact, both sessions, the Republicans walked out and didn't even allow these bills, which would have won, had a majority of support for them. I'm thinking particularly of, I guess you could simply call it cap and trade, but there were a number of bills that Republicans were crying out last session and back in 2019 that these bills were going to hurt rural Oregonians. So what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so these bills are like apples and oranges to cap and trade, right? Cap and trade was looking at how do we regulate greenhouse gases, you know, across the whole state, the transportation, the electric sector, you know, industry. That's not what this bill is looking at. This bill is looking at the electric sector, how our utilities can shift to clean energy, and how they can do it in a way that's good for Oregonians. And it's not that we shouldn't be, you know, looking at how we can reduce emissions from all those other sectors. It's just not what this bill is looking at. And instead, it's really focused on the opportunity that we have to transition to clean energy in a way that actually lifts us up out of this pandemic, right? Like, you know, people have lost their jobs, you know, people have lost a lot of income, and this is an opportunity for real creation of jobs and clean energy in Oregon that we're really excited about. And, you know, for folks who are interested in, you know, the regulation of all of these other industries that are polluting, there's actually a rulemaking process at the Department of Environmental Quality to figure out how does Oregon regulate greenhouse gas emissions, which is a separate thing, but that is ongoing as well.
So that's something that would happen outside of the legislature, and you don't have to worry about the Republicans walking out on it.
Yeah, so that was Governor Brown's executive order. So that's a rulemaking process that is happening as we speak. We're in the middle of it. You know, Rogue Climate is on the rulemaking advisory committee, and we are really there as one of few community organizations. It's mostly industry and fossil fuel corporations, and we're really there to say these rules have to result in a real reduction of fossil fuels, that we know the pollution harms disproportionately Black, Indigenous, and communities of color and low-income rural communities, and that we cannot let corporations buy, sell, trade, bank the pollution that is hurting real people every single day.
Are you being listened to?
Sometimes. I think that there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of opportunity for the public to engage in this rulemaking process. So I think the next Environmental Quality Commission meeting is on May 21st. So if you're interested in advocating for some of the things that I was just talking about in this rulemaking process, you can show up to the Environmental Quality Commission, and I believe Power Past Frack Gas will have some more info on it soon, but we don't have a comment guide up and ready yet. But yeah, to answer your question, I think, you know, the fossil fuel industry has the resources, right? They have the money, they have the lawyers to do all of this fancy work, but we have the numbers, and so we're going to really show up with numbers to make sure that they don't exempt certain industries, and that, you know, we really do see a real reduction in fossil fuels and the pollution that harms communities on a day-to-day.
Well, if Oregonians can bring Jordan Cove to their knees, I hope they can bring a sense of what a real green renewable future is to DEQ. So
I hope so, yeah.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Ali Rosenbluth, who's the campaign's director with Rogue Climate in Jackson County. Well, Ali, in the last few minutes, I just wanted to get an update on what's going on down your way with Rogue Climate, with the community of talent and the rest of Southern Oregon that was burnt out so badly last fall. I mean, the last time we talked actually was very briefly after FERC did that surprise upholding of Oregon's regulatory power. But before that, the last time we talked in depth was actually in the middle of the fires. So I wanted to know, do you guys have an office and what is happening?
Yeah. So the Alameda fire, which happened on September 9th this fall or summer, really had a devastating impact in Southern Oregon. Especially in the communities of Phoenix and Talent. And yeah, you know, as you know, Barbara, it burned down our office. And it also burned down 3,000 structures, which were primarily low-income housing occupied by the Latinx community here in Southern Oregon. So we, you know, thousands of people have been displaced, and there's still hundreds who are displaced still, have no place to live. Are living in hotels, are living in intense on the Greenway, which is now becoming more and more criminalized in Southern Oregon. And people are still trying to figure out what to do. So Rogue Climate and a bunch of our incredible partners in Southern Oregon, including the Rogue Action Center, the Southern Oregon Health Equity Coalition, the Southern Oregon Racial Equity Coalition, jumped into action with so many more groups. I can't even name them all, but you know who you are, who, started creating these mutual aid stations throughout the communities that had been impacted. And at one point, I think we had four sites running. And we've since, the last 9 months have reduced it to just one here in Phoenix, where people can come and get food and supplies and get connected to resources. The space is bilingual, so it's accessible to people who don't speak English, which has been so, so critical throughout this process. We are, still seeing hundreds of people every week come in to that station to get help. You know, the biggest need that we hear is something that it's housing, right? And it has always been housing in Southern Oregon. There's always been a housing crisis. But with the fire, most of the low-income housing in the Rogue Valley just burned. So the impacts are still here. I really do feel like the fire isn't over, right? Like, we're still really living in this, crisis and this, natural disaster. Like, every day when I drive to work, I drive through the burn scar and I see, friends' homes that used to be there no longer there. And, I'm lucky that I didn't lose my home, but it's something that will, impact you for the rest of your life, right? And so it's something that we're still really in the midst of. And we really have an incredible team and an incredible community in Southern Oregon that has really just showed up for each other. And hopefully because of that, at the end of this, our community will be better off than we were before the fire. And we will, make sure that we are bringing our neighbors home as soon as possible.
Well, one of the things that I learned last fall, I was talking to Dominic Della Sala, actually in the same show that you were on, talking about the fire, and he was talking about watching from the hill. He lives also in Talent, but the part of Talent that didn't burn. And he was watching all these buildings explode. Actually, they were all basically trailers and the trailer parks on the other side of the highway from him in Talent. And he realized that they were propane tanks that were blowing up, and that was what really caused a lot of the devastation. And I'm wondering if there's thought about how, when you're mentioning that be hopefully money in this bill that will hopefully pass to harden homes in rural Oregon against fire, if there's thought about finding alternatives so people don't have to have propane tanks and other ways that would also protect their homes.
Yeah, so one thing that we often don't think about when we think about protecting our homes is actually electrification is a really, really, really smart way to get rid of the safety and health impacts of gas, like propane and natural gas that people have piped in to their homes. That was another thing that we saw, were gas pipelines just spewing gas that was on fire in the middle of the fire, right? That happened. The Oregon Healthy Homes Bill doesn't quite take on electrification at the moment, but that could be something that in future sessions we prioritize funding for to make sure that low-income community members have access to electrification because it is expensive. And the thing is that it's expensive to do, but once you are all electric, you save, right? And what we're seeing with the gas industry, right, is that prices are going to keep going up and up and up and up. And what we don't want to see is low-income communities who haven't been able to, electrify their homes, or whose landlords choose not to electrify their homes, have to pay the highest costs of gas when, wealthy America and middle-class America have already transitioned off of it. So that's something that we really do have to be thinking about. Not just for the climate and the health concerns and the safety concerns, but also just not leaving working class people behind.
Well, actually, Northwest Natural Gas is doing this really heavy greenwashing campaign where they are coming out against any kind of efforts. It's mostly in Washington state where I think they're actually really going to be limiting future natural gas infrastructure. So in Washington state, they're sending out flyers to everybody who's a customer of Northwest Natural Gas, telling them the benefits of gas and how these laws that are being passed in Washington are going to make them pay more money and cost them more and ruin their lives. So I wonder, are you running into problems like that in Southern Oregon too? The other thing I'm thinking about, I've been hearing about Biden's plans to create, you know, broadband everywhere, and particularly it's the broadbandification of rural America, which is being equated with the electrification of rural America under FDR. But it seems to me that rural America still needs some electrification as well, even before you get the broadband in there.
Definitely. Yeah, I live very rurally now, and I need both rural electrification and rural broadband. So I'm super excited if that is something that can come my way. Well, Northwest Natural is actually doing a lot of that same in Oregon right now too, because youth activists and environmental justice leaders in Eugene have been calling for the city of Eugene to end their franchise agreement with Northwest Natural so that they can truly transition off of gas. And then I know in Multnomah County, the county just passed ordinance that actually bans new gas hookups in city buildings, right? So the writing's on the wall. The gas industry, like, gas is horrible for the climate. We know it. Our methane levels are higher than ever, and we're seeing the impacts of climate change right now. It's, you know, expensive. And we have a clear solution, and it's electrification and making sure that our electric power is coming from clean energy, which is why that 100% clean energy bill is important too. And it's totally possible. And I think that we're going to see the gas industry really, really push back and try to push some false solutions out too, like RNG and hydrogen, which we know are still polluting and we also know aren't technically feasible or financially feasible for a transition. So electrification is the way to go. Definitely say, if you haven't looked up what 350 Eugene is doing to pressure the city on that franchise agreement, to go check it out, because 350 Eugene and Sunrise Eugene are doing incredible work.
Well, one last thing. So are you back in a new office? Just want to know how Rural Climate itself is doing, besides being out there helping everybody else.
Yeah, so when we have a fire relief station in Phoenix in this shopping center, and a few doors down was an open space, so we were able to rent that. So we are in a shopping center in Phoenix for the time being, and, you know, nothing could ever replace all of the incredible banners and art and, like, youth projects that were in the office that burned. But we are trying to make this spot home for now. And we're really lucky to have a space, especially when we know so many of our neighbors don't have a place to call home right now.
Well, having you have a place to call home maybe is going to be one of the most helpful things in getting other people to have a place called home.
I hope so.
Well, Ellie, it's great to talk to you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing down there. And I hope for the best, and that the next time that we talk, things will be that much better.
Yeah,
maybe we'll talk again. Maybe we will talk again after Jordan Cove has finally pulled the plug.
Yeah, we'll have a party on the radio, play some fun songs, and really let everybody celebrate the incredible work that they've done to make it happen.
And maybe by then we'll be able to see each other in person.
That would be so fun. I hope so.
Well, thanks a lot, Allie.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Allie Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate in Jackson County. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And now, during our spring pledge drive, you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. And for the rest of the pledge drive, every dollar you donate will be matched one-to-one, up to $10,000, thanks to the generosity of a group of anonymous donors. Make your contributions by May 22nd and double your impact. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting Community Powered Radio. Next week, we talk with Rebecca White with Cascadia Wildland about unbridled clear-cutting taking place in areas that were burned during last summer's fires. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
None of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground. Turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas. None of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground. And turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. We are a people. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around.